All right. Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Our first case this morning is 821-0219, David Paul Anderson versus Leslie Ann Anderson. As all parties are aware, this is a Zoom oral argument. I'm joined today, this is Judge Conley presiding, by Judge Gaitis and Judge Riley. As I'm sure you're aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and finally, appellant's counsel will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. This matter is being recorded, but please keep in mind that our court rules prohibit any private recordings by counsel or anyone in the gallery who is watching this Zoom. So with that, counsel for the appellant, whenever you're ready, you can just tell us who you are in a loud, clear voice, and you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, this is Andrew Lewis, appearing for appellant Leslie Andreessen. And to start, we are here, the issue before the court today is whether the district court had jurisdiction to enter and make the findings, conclusions, and amended judgment that it did concerning division of the party's 401k. The answer in short is that the district court did not have the jurisdiction to do what it did. And that will be borne out by our argument here today and the briefs previously submitted to the court. My client, Leslie Andreessen, was married to Mr. Andreessen for 29 years before their marriage was dissolved in 2009. As it concerns the 401k, it was dissolved pursuant to a dissolution decree entered in December of 2009, but the terms of that decree had been previously stipulated to in April of 2009. As it relates to the 401k, conclusion 9b in the dissolution decree provided the method and manner the party stipulated to for dividing the marital portion of the 401k. The division was to be accomplished pursuant to a qualified domestic relations order, or quadro, to be drafted by outside counsel selected solely by Mr. Andreessen. The decree provided that the marital portion of the 401k was valued as of January 14th, 2009, and the specific amount of that value was stated elsewhere in the decree. Either that amount as of January...
I had one question. I am sorry to interrupt, Mr. Lewis. So in 2012, when the 401k inquest was merged with CenturyLink, respondent calculated the shares, your client's share, to be $33,000. And, you know, you were notified of that, or I should say, counsel at the time was notified that and did not object. Is there an argument that this argument that you're now making now has been waived? Because no one objected to that at the time. And I understand your argument is the court didn't have any jurisdiction, but assuming we may disagree with that, I'm wondering if you could respond to that argument.
Certainly. And the reason that it was not waived at the time is there was nothing in the order that allowed a husband, Mr. Andreessen, to calculate what he thought to be Leslie's share and then segregate that on his own accord and have that override the specific terms of the dissolution decree. If that were possible, it opens the door to a lot of sharp practices to get around valid standing decrees. Now, I was not present when that happened in 2012 and do not know the reason there was no response, but my speculation would be that the decree stood and whatever husband did in that regard could not change the terms of the decree or alter the share that my client is entitled to receive. If that were the case, the 401k would have been divided essentially by Mr. Andreessen instead of in the manner agreed upon and stipulated to by the parties previously.
And then I had one follow-up question, Mr. Yeah. Lewis, actually on the jurisdiction question. There's an argument being made that this lack of jurisdiction argument was not raised below. I guess my question is, was this argument raised below to the district court?
Your Honor, I would say as
that sounds like a yes to me, or excuse me, a no.
Oh.
Oh, while I won't interrupt you, go ahead.
I would argue, sir, that the matter was raised before, maybe not artfully. My client was representing herself, but looking at her argument as a whole to the court was that what Mr. Andreessen was advocating for did not follow the agreement, did not follow what the dissolution decree said she would get. And I think we even look at what the district court did, and the district court said that the intent was to follow the decree. Unfortunately, that is not what ended up happening. And I would also say, here that jurisdiction, it's a matter of law. If the court was without authority to act, it was without authority to act. And
you would make the argument that that could be raised at any time.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could shift to the, a little bit to the maintenance issue. First of all, would you agree that we review those decisions as to whether there should be a modification maintenance under an abuse of discretion standard?
Yes, generally, yes.
Why don't you summarize for us how you believe the district court abused its discretion below by terminating maintenance?
Certainly. One of the biggest way the district court would have abused its discretion is in considering hypothetical, non-existent, speculative expenses that Mr. Andreessen alleged that he thought he might.
This the rent issue?
The rent and the other utilities.
I understand he was living with his sisters, I recall. So your position is there's no indication he's going to get his own apartment, and your client believes he would still continue remaining with the sister, and thus, that is a phony expense. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yes, my client.
What's the basis for that belief that Ms. Hunt's client is fabricating or misrepresenting his intentions?
The problem there isn't so much on whether he's intending to or not, or whether that's legitimate. It's the fact that at the time he moved to terminate maintenance, he was not incurring those expenses. And the statute that allows for modification of maintenance requires an actual change in circumstances.
Well, let's back up to that then, because my understanding is, the trial court found that the decrease in husband's retirement was, his retirement is reasonable given husband's health, employment history, the party's expectations regarding when he would retire at the time of the divorce and other circumstances. And so his income decreased substantially with his retirement. Are you saying that those are erroneous findings of fact by the district court?
Not as to that, the fact that his income decreased. The problem is that when included in his expenses, these speculative expenses that he may or may not actually incur at some point, change his monthly cash flow from about $1,000 monthly surplus into a $300-some monthly shortfall. And now, if he had actually incurred those expenses at some point in the future, I don't know whether he has or has not, that is not in the record, then he could come and make that claim. But to make it prematurely, the law, as I read the statute, does not allow that. And just as a matter of policy, if litigants could include expenses that they expected to incur, even expenses that they in good faith expected to incur, it would open a floodgate of people. It also opened the door to more unscrupulous people asserting, oh, I might incur these expenses in an effort to reduce or eliminate maintenance.
Mr. Lewis, on that point, mm-hmm. on the expenses, again, was this argument raised below?
Yes, it was. My client pointed out pointedly in the, I guess you'd call it a post-hearing brief that the district court solicited from her in lieu of a proposed order, that pointed out that he is not actually incurring these expenses. And she questioned whether he actually would, but the point was the same, that until he's incurring them, we can't know for sure whether they're accurate or not. Nevertheless, the district court went on to find that it was appropriate to include those expenses.
Well, on the other side of the equation, the 2009 decree thought that your client would be able to earn at least $25,000 in gross annual income over a short period of time, over a number of years. And there was, I don't think any evidence presented. She isn't earning that at this point. There was no evidence presented about her efforts to get a better paying job or what she was doing to come up to the $25,000, as I read the record.
I would disagree slightly. She did testify before the court that she earned an associate's degree in, I think it was dietetics and nutrition from Normandale Community College, and did make efforts to find employment in that field, but that was unsuccessful. So I would say that her testimony would be evidence of her efforts, but I do acknowledge that the district, that the record does not show that she submitted things like rejection letters or other maybe documentary evidence on that regard, but there would be the her own testimony. And also, with husbands to there's also, excuse me for a moment. And the only evidence that Mr. Andreessen provided that she could be earning that was the essentially testimony of his counsel that it's a good job market generically, and that, oh, I saw some sign on my way to court today that said now hiring for, I was unclear what position or what amount. And so the record is relatively scant across the board about on from his side on that too.
You've got about a minute to sum up, Mr. Lewis, so perhaps you want to hit your key points.
Yeah. I would just raise up here that, especially going back to the 401k issue here, the law provides very narrowly that It provides, first off, that a stipulated decree has the sanctity of a contract and allows narrow basis for amendment, such as to interpret or clarify an ambiguity, which we argue does not exist in this case, and that went unrebutted. And also, they're allowed to issue orders implementing decrees, such as the judge's order here that determined how the outside counsel is to be paid for to draft the quadro. But as we pointed out in our brief, in adopting husband's calculation of how this 401k should be divided, they don't identify the impasse the court was allegedly resolving or how adopting the calculation resolved that impasse. And in fact, these calculations were represented to the district court at different times as either being an faithful calculation of the decree or an alternative when it couldn't be calculated.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis, and you will have time for rebuttal. We'll now hear from counsel for the respondent, please.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt and I represent the respondent, David Andreessen. Respondent respectfully requests that the trial court be affirmed. A trial court, as this court has recognized on multiple occasions, may issue appropriate orders to implement or enforce a dissolution decree, and such orders are reviewed for an abuse of discretion. A trial court confronted a decade later by circumstances not anticipated at the time of the judgment has discretion to implement the judgment as appropriate under the circumstances, provided it does not alter the rights that are otherwise final under the judgment. So, for example, in Hansen, this court affirmed the trial court's conversion of one party's share of marital property to a cash award after the parties were unable to agree on a physical division of the property. A party's substantive rights are altered if the order implementing the dissolution judgment decreases the party's share of the marital property. Here, appellant has not shown that the trial court's ordered implementation decreased appellant's awarded share of marital property. I mean, there simply is no abuse of discretion in what has been awarded. Now, the argument before the trial court was the amount of the 401k lump sum to be awarded, not that the judgment could not be amended in this fashion. Appellant had argued before the trial court.
Ms. Hunt?
Yes.
In the reply brief at page 6, appellant says that your client said on July 31st that he had calculated faithfully and by applying conclusion 9B to divide the 401k, but that on November 7th, he said that it couldn't be applied as written. How do you respond to that argument?
There isn't any inconsistency in what respondent informed the court. What respondent was informing the court was, here is, you know, given the circumstances now, here is how you implement the judgment and decree. So I don't see that there was ever any inconsistency, but there was the need for it to be done, because what happened was, is appellant came before the trial court saying, I should receive $139,689.98 from respondent's 401k. Now, what you can see on appeal is that argument's been abandoned by appellant. The appellant is not making any argument that the trial court made an error in not adopting her calculation. He's arguing that there was some kind of error, I guess, in awarding appellant's calculation, but there is none. If conclusion of law 9B had been implemented at the time of the divorce, the results would have been as follows. As the documented value of the 401k as of January 15, 2009 was $43,743. If you take out the taxes of $8,902, which are taxes at 20.35%, that equals $34,841. Now you take out the debt of respondent of $13,970, the debt of appellant of $9,204, That equals 11,667 divided by 2, that's 5,833. So appellant would have received $5,833 as her share of the 401k after payment of the debt. Now, as the court is well aware, it wasn't implemented in 2009. So in 2012, recognizing that there had not been this division per the judgment and decree, and both parties had paid their respective debts, and because respondent's 401k was changing due to Quest, his employer, merging with CenturyLink, respondent sent a letter to appellant's lawyer stating, here's how I've calculated, here's what I'm planning to do. I'm segregating that amount in a 2025 target date fund, which would correspond with appellant's presumed date of retirement. And he sets out his calculations. Not only did he set out his calculations, he provided appellant's counsel with like 26 pages of the documentation from the 401k that corresponds with that. And so there was nothing heard back. And Judge Conley, you asked if that's a waiver. Yes, I believe that is a waiver, because at that point, respondent's understanding was, well, I've done what I need to do. The ball's in appellant's court. So what we have here is we've been having this amount sitting in this targeted fund segregated. And so in June 2019, when the motion is brought before the court, the amount was now at $60,402.65. And so respondent requested that that court designate that amount as appellant's share of the 401k plus any investment earnings since then because the market has improved. So accordingly, the account itself will adjust for gains and losses until division, and the trial court agreed to that. There simply is no abuse of discretion in reaching that result. Turning to the termination of the spousal maintenance, there was also no abuse of discretion there. The undisputed facts are at the time of the award of spousal maintenance, respondents' expenses have increased from $2,655 to $3,356 a month. His income has gone down from $4,784 to $2,080 a month, or 37%, because of retirement. So that leads to a shortfall. Now we look at appellant. She admits her expenses have gone down from $3,400 to $2,800. The trial court found the record does not support a finding that appellant is incapable of earning at least $25,000 gross annual income. And $25,000, she would have $2,083 per month. Plus, her income has increased by receiving $892 a month from appellant's pension. So her monthly expenses are covered. So based on the record, there simply isn't an abuse of discretion to terminate respondent's spousal maintenance obligation. And respondent respectfully requests that this court affirm the trial court in all respects.
Thank you, Ms. Hunt. Mr. Lewis, you'll have the last word, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to start by responding to the statement that in 2012, it was Mr. Andreessen's position that by segregating the funds and sending notice to my client's then counsel, that he had done what he needed to do. That, quite frankly, is false. He, at the time, he was not cooperating with doing what the decree said, and that is dividing the 401k and turning over my client's rightful share of the 401k to her. And there's been no explanation for why, at that time, Mr. Andreessen did not seek to comply with the order. He claims that, well, I didn't say who should pay for it. And, well, as he's perfectly capable of, or could, he could have brought a motion to clarify that or done something to further the division instead of what he did, which has compounded the problems in this matter. another thing I would like to respond to is just the nature of the calculations. And again, there is an inconsistency. It was clear from the record that in August of 2019, when these calculations were first presented, the district court said, we're going to follow the agreement. We're going to do what the agreement says. And that it understood that these calculations were an implementation of conclusion 9B, which it wasn't, as we've explained in our briefs. And then 3 months later, they say, oh, we can't implement it. Here, adopt this conclusion as an alternate. One of the problems is in August, there was no talk about that the decree couldn't be implemented as written. And so I think there is a, I do not agree with the statement that there is no inconsistency with the way Mr. Andreessen represented his calculations. And I'd also like to say that here below, my client was representing herself and looking at what relief she sought from the court, looking at what she said to the court and taking it as a whole, it's clear that she was doing her best to fight just to get what is rightfully owed to her under the decree and to make sure that she wasn't shortchanged by actions taken by her ex-husband in the 10 years that this was not divided. And on appeal, we're arguing just the same thing, that she should get what the decree says. The debate over numbers was something that should have never have occurred in the first place. It simply should have been, the decree should have been enforced as written, which provides a standard, says here's your marital portion as of January 2009. It's adjusted for gains and losses until it is divided, which is just a standard way of bridging the gap, usually much shorter than this, but from the date of the agreed stipulated terms versus the implementation of the terms. It shouldn't have been a debate over calculations at that point, or at least not until there was the quadro was drafted and there was some disagreement as to whether it actually implemented the order as written. And lastly, I'd like to point out that in the court's findings and orders, it makes no reference to any change in circumstance or unexpected circumstance that arose that it was addressing. And merely the court says there was a dispute over what is marital property. But yet the court should have just referred the parties back to their original decree, which clearly spells out what is marital property. Thank you, Your Honor, and the court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. Thank you very much, Ms. Hunt. We appreciate the thoughtfulness of your briefs and arguments. We will issue our decision within 90 days. We'll now move on to our next case, please.